Thank you, Jeremy. My name's George O'Neill, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to thank Milton for asking us to come down here. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank the committee for the fine job that you've done, making us feel at home and making us feel welcome, and the love you shared with us and the love you gave us. Because it's real nice. We came here last year with the couple that led. They talked. I call it a lead. In our area, we call them leads. You guys call them speakers. I'm no speaker. You could tell that by the way I talk, you know. So I make a lead. I just get up here and open my mouth, and whatever God says to say comes out. But I want to thank y'all, and it's nice to see old friends Juanita and Dave, Bob. I've known them since I was fairly new in the program. And it's nice to see them, and it's nice to see a lot of old friend Milton. And it's just great to be here. And I'm having a good time, you know. And I'm glad I'm retired, because I don't have to rush out, and I don't have to go nowhere, and I don't have to go no place. And if you get tired of listening before I get tired of talking, shut the machine off and go ahead. It's okay. Because I want to hear what I got to say, because I might say something good I don't ever know, you know. But I'll tell you, I had my last drink on April 26, 1970, and I'm a member in good standing of the Hubbard Wednesday Night AA group. And my sponsor told me, he said, if you don't know when you had your last drink, it wasn't. He said, and if you can't remember when you had your last drink, he said, pick a date and work from there. He said, and that's what the guys in the South say. So, you know, I'm a Yankee, but I want to fit in. And that works for me. See, my sponsor told me to get a home group, someplace that I belong, so that when I'm not there, I'm missed, and people will inquire about me. He said, because you were like a gypsy when you drank. He said, and when you stand up behind a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, put on a shirt and a tie and look like something. He said, because you look like a damn bum when you drank. And I do these things, and they work for me, and I enjoy them. I was sober 10 years, going to meetings with a shirt and a tie on. When I came to the program, you never knew who was leading, because everybody wore a shirt and a tie. I got a motorcycle, and I was sober about, I don't know, 11 years, 10 years, somewhere around there. I ride my motorcycle to the meeting, I didn't have a tie on. One of these old hard-nosed AA lady said to me, where's your tie? I said, I can't wear no tie. I'm riding my motorcycle. She said, wear a tie when you come to this meeting. Okay, I said, I'd wear that tie. That thing be flying around, going down the road, you know. And these things work. See, they work. It was really, I tell you in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And in so doing, I hope to give you an undiluted message of hope, because that's all I have to give. I have hope to give. There's hope here. I found hope here when I came. I'll tell you a little bit. I grew up on the east side of Youngstown. Youngstown was a steel town. My dad worked on a railroad, had buses running. I loved the buses. I liked the night. I liked to be outside. We lived in a place called the Flats for a while. It was two rows of apartment houses and had a little tin shop there in the alley. And I'd go out at night. I'd put my coat on. My mother would say, where are you going? I'd say, I got to go check on things, Mom. It was okay. I was 5 years old. I could walk around a neighborhood. Nobody'd bother you, you know. And I'd walk around, make my tour, and come back like I was some big shot or something, you know. My dad was a barbershop quartet singer. People would come to our homes, and they would sing songs, and they would have a few drinks, and they would laugh. Sometimes they'd move the furniture back, roll the carpet up, and somebody would play the piano, and they'd dance, and they'd have a lot of fun. And I thought, boy, them people that drink, they sure have fun. And I just never thought no more about it. I just thought they had fun. And I thought, someday if I ever drink, I'll have fun too. And I grew up, I was born and raised a Catholic. I was an altar boy till I was 27 years old. And I quit serving Mass because I started waking up from blackouts while Mass was going on. That's pretty bad if you don't know if you rang the bell or it's time to ring the bell or you know. And I thought, man, you can't do this, George. You know, you're a hypocrite, so I quit doing that. But I had a good upbringing. My mother and father had a lot of love in their home. in our home, and they loved us. I'm the oldest son. I have three older sisters, and them sisters love me to death. And I have two younger brothers, and a younger brother passed away. Him and my wife, Carol, God rest their souls, they passed away within 9 months of each other. And it was traumatic for me because I lost my two very best friends within 9 months. But you see, I didn't have to drink because it wouldn't have brought them back. But anyway, I grew up and I went to high school and I played sports and I liked sports. And I didn't have any problem with girls. I like girls. And I still like girls. They smell good and they're soft. And boy, I like them, you know. You know, I like them. And I like them hugs, you know. I like them hugs. And when I came to AA, my sponsor told me, he said, if you keep coming back, he said, those ladies that look nice and smell good, he said, they'll hug you too. And I said, okay, I'd shake hands with everybody, see, because I didn't want to do nothing to cross them, you know, because I figured if I don't do what he says, he'll tell everybody what a bum I am, and you'll kick me out of AA, see. So I thought, well, I got to do what he says. But anyway, I grew up in I played a little football in high school, and I could have went to a little college, and I worked hard. And I thought, well, I think I'm going to go into Golden Gloves. And I would train hard for 6 months. Boy, I mean, I was religious about it. Every morning I'd get up, I'd run 5 or 8 miles, and I mean, I'd run. I didn't jog, I'd run, because I wanted to get in shape, and I was going to be a good fighter, because I thought that's what I wanted to be. And I went down to the YMCA, and there was an old guy there. This guy was 36 years old. He was old, you know. He's a baby now. He said, you want to go a few rounds? Sure. I put the gloves on with him. Hoo-hoo-hoo. That man changed my lifestyle in 3 minutes. He taught me I was no fighter. George comes home, he got a broken nose, 2 black eyes. I wasn't cut up, though. So my dad looked at me, and my dad looked like a 5'8" leprechaun. He had white hair, he had sparkling blue eyes, and he had a big smile. You know, my dad was a happy person. And he looked at me, and he said, what in the world got a hold of you? And I told him, he said, George, that guy used to be a professional fighter. Oh, I said, I hit him good once, Dad. My dad looked at me, he said, thank God you didn't hit him twice. And he was right, see? And I thank God I didn't hit him twice, you know? Anybody here that's ever been in a fight, you know, when you're getting your clock cleaned and you get that one good one in, you think you won. You didn't, the lights went out after that, but you don't care, you know? I got my good lick in. And this is how my life was going. I had a couple little college offers. I could have went to school and played ball, but I got working in a foundry. And I was making good money. And I thought it would last forever. And I thought, I don't need to go to college. I'm making good money. I'm making money hand over fist because I like a nice car and I like nice clothes and I like nice things. And I knew that I had to work to get those things. Because I was about that big. My dad told me, Georgia boy, no work, no eat. Clean the grass, cut the grass, you know, do the chores around the house. That was what I had to do. And we had a work ethic, you know. So that's how things were going. I graduated from high school and got to working in this foundry, and I hadn't had a drink yet. You know, all the guys I worked with, they drank. I didn't drink. Gals I ran with, they all drank. I'm getting in fights, and I'm not even a drunk, you know. And I'm wondering, what's going on here? And they'd ask me the next day, what happened? Where'd we go? What'd we do? I said, geez, if that booze does that to them guys, why did they drink it? Little was I to know that someday that was going to be me. What happened? Where was I? But anyway, I went to this wedding, and I had my first drink, first drunk, first blackout, and I was a blackout drinker. And I was at this friend's sister's wedding, and everybody was drinking. And I went to the bar, and a fella said to me, what are you drinking? I said, I'm having a beer, because I'm full of that squirting 7-Up clear up to here. And the bartender put a beer down, and I picked it up, and I drank it down just like you drink a glass of water. Dipped that bottle up. When I put it down, it was empty. I said, whew, give me another one of them. Because it was a hot day. And he put another one out there, and I picked it up, and I drank it down. I seen them guys drinking them shots. I thought, if I'm drinking all this, I'm going to get bloated up. So I switched to whiskey. And I fell in love. I fell in love with that whiskey. But see, a lot of things haven't happened to me yet by the grace of God. I haven't had a DWI yet. I haven't been in prison yet. I haven't been in jail yet. I haven't lost a job yet. I haven't lost a home yet. I haven't lost a family yet. All these things yet. That's right. And I look in the mirror and I say, you're eligible too. Because all these things are in the bottle and they're waiting on me, and I'm the only one that can take them out and put them on me. No one can cause me to take a drink. No one. Because my book says our dilemma was lack of power. And there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And I know. See, I found him. Because I found him in the third step. So I know that as long as I do the things I'm supposed to do, all those yets are going to stay in that bottle. And they're going to wait on me. But I come home from this wedding this day. And I don't know how I got home. My car was in the drive. Next day, get up, go to church. Because Mother had made sure everybody went to church on Sunday. And if you didn't go to church, I'm 22 years old. You don't go nowhere. If you don't go to church on Sunday, you're too sick to go anywhere on Sunday. You're too sick to go anywhere. That was the rules. Take it or leave it. Like it or not, that's the rules. So 10:30, I had to crawl out of bed, run down the stairs, and I wondered where my car was. It was in the garage. Looked at it, not smashed up, not scratched, nothing, just sitting there. And I walked outside, and that sunlight hit me like it was shining this morning. And I got sick, and I ran beside the garage, and I threw up, and I said, boy, I'm never going to do that again. And to this day, I haven't smoked a Philip Morris cigarette. Because I figured that's what was doing it. Those Philip Morris cigarettes were too sweet. I made myself a promise. I'm not going to do that no more. 2 weeks later, I'm in the same shape on a Sunday morning, and I'm wondering what happened to me. And as my drinking went on, I took these little inventories. What's the matter with you? What's the matter with you? Why can't you drink like other people? Why don't you have any fun like them other guys are having? So I'd drink what you were drinking, and I'd stand next to you because I figured maybe the breeze was blowing on you, something happy, and nothing was happening to me, you know? And I'd drink where you drank, and I'd drink what you drank. And I'd drink this, and I'd drink that. And my dad looked at me one time, and he said, why don't you drink like a gentleman? I said, I drink like a gentleman. I drink out of a glass. He said, then you better drink like a man. I said, I do. I drink out of the bottle sometime. He said, you're crazy. I said, I'm just looking for that fun that you guys have when you drink. He said, maybe you better not drink if you're going to act like that. But they went on deaf ears, you know, and I just kept on going. We moved off the east side. We moved to a little town called Struthers, and there I was going to meet the girl that I was going to marry. And her name was Carol, and she was a sweet young thing. And she was 19 years old, and I was 22, and we got married. And I didn't drink at the wedding. I didn't drink. I had two drinks all day because I knew I was afraid to drink because I didn't want to mess it up for her. And I knew that if I got drinking, I'd be in a fight, and I'd be doing all kind of crazy things. So I said, don't drink, George. Don't drink. I said, let your brothers drink for you. Let your dad drink for you. Let your brother-in-law drink. And I didn't drink. And after we went on our honeymoon, we took a bottle of champagne out. Carol had one drink, and I drank it all, you know. And I thought, what's the matter with you? You don't have to drink it all. But I was okay. You know, everything went nice. We come home. We set up housekeeping. I got drafted, went to the service, put my time in. Didn't get in any trouble. Drank with people that drank like I did. We lied and cheated and covered up for each other. Carol came up. I was stationed up at Fort Niagara last 6 months that I was there, and we set up housekeeping, and she looked at me one day and she said, you know, George, you're drinking an awful lot. I said, Carol, when I get back home and get working and get responsibilities, that'll all change. And it changed. It got worse. It got worse. Because I talked her into quitting her job because I didn't have to pick her up, didn't have to be responsible for her. She was at home and I didn't come home. Because I worked in a foundry, and when you work hard, you can drink hard. Because some old guy said that one time when he was falling off a bar stool. He said, I work hard, I drink hard. And I thought, that's my kind of man. First time I got out of the service, I went in a joint to get a bar, and a guy said, I want to see some ID from you. I said, some what? He said, I want to see some ID. I said, man, I'm 25 years old. He said, you can't prove it by me. The superintendent of the plant was there. He said, yeah, he's old enough. He said, I got to see some ID from this guy. I had a driver's license, which I still had, and I showed him that. He said, okay. So then I started carrying my birth certificate. You know, people would ask me, I want to see some ID. I'd show them. They'd say, you don't look that old. Whose birth certificate? And I said, forget about it. So I'd have somebody else get me drinks. You know, that I didn't want no hassle. I didn't like hassle. I didn't even like hassle when I was a drunk. I didn't like hassle. But things were going from bad to worse. We were married for about 5 years, and we didn't have any children. Carol said, I think we ought to see about adopting a baby. I said, Carol, that sounded like a good idea to me. And we were living in an apartment in Hubbard, and the man who owned the apartment, his name was Fred Miller. And boy, that Fred, he drank like I drank, and I liked to drink with him. And I'd be out there in the wintertime shoveling a drive, little driveway. I'd run the snow, shovel around it, and he'd come home about 9:30, 10 o'clock. He worked in a liquor store, great place for an alcoholic to work, you know. He say, George, you cold? He say, you want a drink? Yeah, Fred, I could stand one, you know. So we proceed to get drunk. But then Fred started getting mean and nasty and shouting and yelling. And I said, man, why is he like that, you know? I didn't know that was going to be me. And we got this little boy. We adopted a little boy. His name was Georgie. We named him Georgie, and my dad was proud as a peacock. George John O'Neill III, you know. And I loved that little boy, but I didn't know how to show him. See, I didn't know how to show him. I didn't abuse him. I didn't mistreat him because I was afraid of myself. But we're living in this apartment, and I know this boy got to go to college, so I got to get another job. And I'm making good money in this foundry. I'm a supervisor by now, and I'm making good money. We got this little boy, and I was one of these sneaky drunks. I'd bring my paycheck home, and I'd throw it on the table. And I'd let Carol take care of it, and I'd let her make all the decisions and whatever she said. I said, that sounded like a good idea to me, Carol, because that way I didn't have to make a decision, and if something was wrong, nobody got the blame but her. See, I didn't have no blame because I didn't make no decision. I tell her, I didn't care what you do. Just do whatever you want to do. It's all right with me, you know. And I'd wonder where the money went because I would say, what happened to all our money? I'm bringing my money home. What are you doing with it? Well, she was setting it aside for a down payment on a house. Because she told me one day, I'm not raising a baby in an apartment. Okay, that sounded like a good idea to me, Carol. So I start, another guy and I, we start a construction company, L&L, late and looped. Get on a job late, get looped, and quit early. And here about 10 years ago, I threw some stationery away that we had made. You know, we were big-time drunks, you know, stationary with our letterhead on it, you know. It was crazy. I come home this one night, and he pushed me up the steps. And when I got home, all I wanted to do was lay down. And I laid my head down on my lunch bucket. I carried one of the metal lunch buckets for almost 35 years. I laid my head down in that and went to sleep. Next morning, I woke up, and I'm at the worship and at the porcelain throne, and I reach up, and I had real long curly hair at the time. And I reached up and I touched that hair, and boy, my whole body got electrocuted. And I thought, oh my God, she got this toilet hot wire. And I'm looking for the hot wire going to the toilet, and I don't see it. And I'm looking in that toilet. I said, you puked up one of your electrolytes. That's why you're getting shocked when you touch that hair. And I'm there looking for it, and I'm wondering what it looked like. And I figured it looked like a little battery with a computer chip on it. And I couldn't find it. And I said, oh, you're in trouble. Then I said, no. Those Martians were trying to beam you up last night, and they were attracting you by the hair, and you kept falling because you was drunk. And I went to work, and I had a tough day. And every chance I get, I'd take this hard hat off. I'd feel this hair, and I'm soaking wet with sweat, and I'm walking around. I got the home maintenance department checking this bench because there's a short in it somewhere. That's why I'm getting shocked. And in our shower room, we had these metal grab arms, irons, and I was afraid to touch them. Because I thought, if that water's coming out and my electrolytes are out of whack and I touch one of them, I'm going to get electrocuted and die right there. Alcoholic thinking. I put a tough time in. I took a shower and I went home and it was quiet. Carol was there and the baby was there. She didn't say nothing to me. I didn't say nothing to her. So I went to bed. Got up the next morning. My eyes opened up. I reached up, touched my hair, and I got electrocuted in bed. And I thought, my God, what's the matter with you? Didn't say nothing, got out, went to work. I'm standing on that bench soaking wet with sweat because I worked on a pouring floor. Number one winehead comes by because I worked with six guys that had the same name as me, winehead. Two of them run overhead crane. I was a supervisor and three other ones worked on the floor. And I was the winehead supervisor of the winehead crew and I didn't even drink wine yet. I'm standing there, number one winehead come by. What's the matter, George? I said, oh, man. I said, I don't know. I said, every time I touch this hair, I'm getting electrocuted. What? I said, I've been touching this hair for 2 days, and I'm getting electrocuted. Just about that time, number two winehead come by. What's the matter with George? Oh, man, every time he touches hair, he's getting electrocuted. Number one winehead said, what's causing that? Number two winehead said, don't you know what that is? My ears got about that big because I wanted to hear every word he said. He said, that's the first sign of kidney trouble. Now, that tells you how stupid this alcoholic standing before you is, because I think something as delicate as my kidneys, and I believe what somebody tells me in a foundry that's so dirty some days you can't see this far in front of you because of the dust. But now I knew it was wrong. I got kidney trouble, and I got to do something about it. I get in that shower, I'm holding on to that handrail, I'm letting that water run on me because I know I'm not going to get electrocuted because my kidneys are shot. See, that's the problem. I go home, Carol had a nice dinner, baby's all cleaned up. She looked at me, she said, how are you? I said, oh, I got a few bad burns. I've been burned on every part of my body from that hot metal. She said, oh. I said, Carol, you got to call me a kidney specialist tomorrow. She said, what? I said, I found out. Pardon me, I found out at work today that I got kidney trouble. She said, what? I said, the last 2 days, every time I touch my hair, my whole body gets electrocuted. I said, I found out it's my kidneys going bad. So you got to call me kidney specialist. Now, Carol was a beautiful young lady, you know. She was 5'10" or 5'11". And when we talked, we looked eyeball to eyeball. And when she wanted to get my attention, she would call me O'Neill. And she stood up and she said, O'Neill, and I stood up too because I didn't know what was coming. She said, the other night you came home, she said, and you laid down in the hall. She said, now, if the baby woke up, I'd have to step over you. So she said, I was going to slide you in the bedroom. Well, the hall was carpeted and the bedroom door was from here to where that radiator is in the corner. She was going to slide me down the hall and put me in the bedroom, get me out of the way. She said, I saw that curly head on that lunch bucket. She said, I reached down, I grabbed that hair and gave a jerk, and you didn't slide. She said, and I banged that head on that bucket, and when it quit bouncing, she said, I jerked again. She said, and you didn't slide. She said, I kept jerking and banging, and I could see her getting fired up. And I started doing that moonwalk before it was in style. I'm starting to ease away from her because I don't know what's going to happen. And she said, I kept jerking and banging and jerking and banging, and she said, I don't remember stopping. And in all my alcoholic stupidity, I looked at her and I said, you mean I don't have no kidney trouble? Well, I need to know what to do. God love you. I like to watch your face. You're a sweet lady, you know that? I said, I got to go get a haircut. And I went, I got one like this. I sat in that chair, and that barber said to me, you want a what? I said, give me one of them Army GI haircuts. I said, give me one of them. Well, you know, I got a funny head. Looks like a mushroom was sitting on a lily pad, you know? It's like a little fat neck and a little fat head. I walked back home, walked in the door. Carol looked at me, her eyes got that big. I said, see what you made me do? See, I blamed everything on everybody. Never took the blame for myself. Never responsible for my own actions. Always wanted to blame somebody else. We moved out of that apartment. We got a contractor to build us a house. Fred got sober. Carol took him over to the receiving hospital, took him to have his last drink, in fact. He told her after I got sober, he said, Carol, you know, you made a 12-step call on me and you didn't even know it. And she told me, I said, I think Fred got a drinking problem, hon. See, I could point the finger, you know, I could point the finger. I knew who was having problems. I could tell you how to raise your kids and how to treat your wife, you know. My dad told me how to treat your wife with respect and love them. And he said, you're welcome here anytime, long as you're together. He said, and don't ever think you're coming home without Carol. So that was a matter of fact. So I had to stay with her, you know. So we're living in this house and things are going from bad to worse. And she said, I think we ought to go see about adopting another baby. I said, that sounded like a good idea to me, Carol. And I was happy for about 20 seconds. Because I was slowly getting moved out of first place. That little boy had more toys than me at Christmas time. And I went and bought some of them. And I got what you fine people told me was a resentment. See? I didn't know this. I didn't know these names for feelings. I didn't know resentment. I knew fear, and I knew frustration, and I knew anger. But I didn't know what caused these. I didn't know resentment and guilt and remorse caused these things. I just had a crappy feeling all the time, and I didn't know what to do about it. Carol said, we got to paint this house. I said, the plaster got to dry. 5 years later, I'm telling her the plaster got to dry. Sixth year, I come home, she got a 5-gallon paint, a paintbrush, and she's going over these brushes. And the little babies are walking around with their fingerprints, you know, and she's going with a Brillo pad, getting them off. I said, wait a minute. She said, paint this house. I said, okay. So I went and got 25-gallon of beige paint, oil-based paint. I painted a whole house beige. She said, I don't like beige ceilings. I went and got 20-gallon of white paint. I painted all the ceilings white, and the walls were ceilings white, beige walls with speckles. Because you know when you go. She said, that looks terrible. I said, it's imaginative. I said, it looks good. In 1985, a tornado hit our house, and there was one closet that didn't have any paint in it. I said, if we leave this alone, I said, all the moisture will come out there. Okay, she said. So it didn't have no paint on it, but we often laughed about it. But anyway, things are going from bad to worse. I'm having trouble at work. I'm having trouble at home. I don't know what to do. I got this fear and this frustration and this anger in me, and I got this rage inside of me, and I don't know what's causing it, and I don't know what to do about it. I hadn't become an everyday drinker yet when I came to You Find People in AA, except the last 2 months I was drinking 2 bottles of NyQuil, mixing it with a pint of Thunderbird wine, and that stuff makes you take back stuff you didn't steal. And that's how I was living. My life was crazy. I knew everybody at work that drank. I knew where they kept their stock. I knew what they drank. I knew what time they went on break. I knew when I could sneak over and get a drink out of their bottle or out of their stock or out of their supply. And they did the same thing to me, see. I had a good superintendent. He didn't fire me because he knew Carol and my children. And he knew that if I lost my job, what would happen to them? And I did the best that I could with what I had to work with, which wasn't much. Because I had no self-esteem, I had no confidence. I had lots of problems because I would let other people make decisions for me pertaining to my job, and it got me in a lot of trouble, and I had to take a lot of heat for it. And I just say, I don't know what happened, you know, but I know. And I got to the point where I lie quicker than drop of a hat, you know, and I didn't know why. And I didn't know what it was going to happen to me, and I look at myself and I say, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you, George? What's wrong with you? Well, this is wrong, and that's wrong, and they're wrong, and he's wrong, and she's wrong, and no wonder if you had the problems I got, you'd drink too. And I made all these excuses, and I was always going to take the pledge, and I was always going to go on a wagon, and I was always just going to drink one, and I was going to come home, and I was going to drink this, and I was going to drink that, and I wasn't going to drink with these people or those people. And by the time I came to You Find People, if I had money to drink with, nobody would drink with me. If I had money to pay for 18 holes of golf and buy the cart and buy everything, nobody would play golf with me. Nobody would go fishing with me. Nobody would go hunting with me. And I wondered why. And my brother, who was 3 years younger than me, and he was a big fella, kind gentleman. He said, I'm not going to drink with you anymore. I said, why? He said, because you get too mean when you drink. He said, you're the only drunk I ever saw that could fight. He said, you get crazy when you drink, George. He said, I never saw anybody like you. He said, and I don't like your type of people when I drink. He said, when I have a couple drinks, I like to have fun and laugh. And he did, and he didn't drink with me. And that made me sad because he usually had lots of money. And one day, a little guy about this big says to me, let's roll your brother and take his money. I said, be my guest. I said, I don't want no part of him. He said, he's going to leave, and he got all the money. I said, well, tell him, give you $5. So he goes over, he gives Tom. Tom gives him 10. I said, what did he tell you? I said, I could tell you what he said. What did he say? He said, don't drink it all in one place. That's right, he said. He said, and tell George to go home. That's right, he said. I said, tell me to go home. He said, okay. He said, go home. I said, okay, let's go across the street. So we went across the street and got drunk. You know, I mean, that's how I lived my life. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know that I suffered from a disease called alcoholism. When I was 10 years old, my friend's dad got sober. And he was going to an AA meeting, and I knew that they were going to ride the bus, and I wanted to ride the bus. So he asked me if I want to go to a meeting with him. I said, I got to go home and ask my dad. And I went and asked my dad, can I go to a meeting with Mr. Walsh and Ray? And he said, yeah, it won't hurt you. He said, yeah, it won't hurt you. Go ahead, you know. And we washed cups. We were at that meeting, washed cups. And boy, them were a neat bunch of guys, I'll tell you. They were happy and laughing, and they was crazy, and I was enjoying myself, you know. And my dad knew a lot of people in AA, and my dad would bring guys home, and he'd try to sober them up. And I don't know, he'd call people in AA to come and get them, and I'd never see them again, you know. But it was okay. And I had a cousin that died sober in AA, and I didn't know what happened to him because I was still drinking at the time. But I didn't know that he went to AA. I just didn't see him anymore. And things were just going from bad to worse, and Carol's getting ready to walk out. And she comes home from I come home from work one day because I was one of those go-to-work alcoholics, and by this time I'm stealing, working two full-time jobs, stealing and trying to drink, and my life is chaos, utter chaos. I don't know if I'm coming or going, if I'm up or down, I don't know. Carol said, I went to the doctor today. No kidding. I said, what's the matter? She said, we're going to have a baby. Holy mackerel. I was happy for about 10 seconds because we had two little boys and a girl that we had adopted. And now we're going to have another one. And I said, four kids, Carol, me, we only got six chairs at that kitchen set. If something happens to one of them chairs, you know who's going to be sitting on the floor. Better watch yourself. And this is how I valued things. We had the only furniture that had throw rugs, throws. When somebody was coming, Carol would put the throws on because this sweaty drunk would lay on that couch, you know, and I'd sweat. And I did a lot of things that weren't very nice. I'd make my children, I never hit them. I was afraid to hit them. I was afraid to raise my hand to them because I knew me, I'd get crazy. So what I'd do is I'd make them walk around a braided rug. And I'd make their little legs walk around there, and I'd tell them, you're not tired, just keep on walking. You're not tired, just keep on walking. You're not tired, just keep on walking. Well, when they'd fall down, then I'd pick them up, and I'd take them up and put them in bed, and I'd turn all the lights on, and I'd go down the cellar, and I'd get a baseball bat, and I'd sit in my living room with the lights out, and I'd get my quart of gin out of the freezer, and I'd sit there and drink, and I'd say, where are you at? You've been looking in these windows all night. Where are you at now? And I'd walk around the house looking for somebody outside because I was full of fear. I had my last drink on April 26, 1970, the Easter before that. I guess it was Easter. I don't know. I remember time. I don't remember dates too good. I remember before I came to AA and since I've been sober. My sponsor said if I knew dates were important, I'd have kept a diary. But it was a St. Patrick's Day dance. We went to St. Patrick's Day dance and had a great time. And Carol said she had a great time. She said, except the last part of it. She said, you got drunk. And I remember getting drunk and I had a broken leg, which I got. It was just healed up. I just got the cast off that week, which I got at a foreman's party drunk at a nice restaurant. And we go to the St. Patrick's Day dance and she hollered at me, and my brother said something, and my sister-in-law said something. My brother and I married two sisters, so I just put the brake on the car, put it in neutral, and got out, and I said, I'll see you, and I stuck my thumb out, and I got a ride, 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know where I'm going, but I rode for a way, and I said, well, I better get off here, and a guy driving, another whole bunch of people in the car, they was all smoking, and you know, laughing and drinking. And I got off there and I walked downtown and got a cab and went home. And I had to go to work the next day. And I walk in the house and Carol got her back to me. She's at the kitchen sink. And I sat down in a chair and I remember this. She said, you are a drunken SOB and it wasn't sweet old boy. And I said, Carol, don't say that. I said, I'll slap you right in the mouth. Well, Carol, she used some four-letter words I didn't even know she used, and they weren't help, hope, and love. And she got her back to me, and I said, Carol, don't say that to me. I said, I'll punch you right in the mouth. And I got up out of this kitchen chair. She backed up against the kitchen stove, and she had a French knife in her hand that long. And she wasn't ranting and raving, or she wasn't screaming or hollering. But she was very matter-of-factly, and she was very calm and cool and collected. And she said, if you lay a hand on me, I'll put this knife in you. And my God talked to me that night, and it was a strange way that he talked, because I heard a loud voice in my head say, shut up and sit down. And I sat down in that chair, and I was afraid to perspire. I perspire very easy. I had to go outside because I was sitting here laughing so hard during that raffle and everything. I started sweating. I had to go outside. I was afraid to sweat. I was afraid to reach for a cigarette because, man, I thought if I make a quick move, I'll look like a Thanksgiving turkey carcass, you know, because she'll get wacky with that knife. Now, how do you tell your little children that are up in bed hearing this screaming and shouting and this profanity and these threats between two people that they love? How do you tell them it's okay that they think they're going to find somebody dead when they come down in the morning? How do you ease these things? That's why I believe that this is a family disease, and there's AA and there's Al-Anon and there's Alateen, because of the damage that we do to our family. Well, things just got worse. And who do you tell? Who do you tell these things to so you keep them inside, you know? I told a guy that one night. He said, oh, George, he said, I know you feel bad. He said, but I knocked my wife down the cellar steps. He said, she threatened me. He said, and I hit her and I knocked her down the steps. He said, and I'm not proud of that. And I told a guy another thing, and he said, man, that ain't nothing, you know. Listen to what I did, you know. And it was okay, see. I come here and you people understand me. Well, anyway, things were just going to bad to worse. And I had my last drink on a Sunday morning at 5:30, as far as I know. And at 6 o'clock, reportedly, another guy and I hit a tree at a high rate of speed, and I took a windshield out of a car with my face. And the engine split the firewall, and the engine drove right back to the front seat. And that engine was sitting there, and it was red hot, and it didn't catch the car on fire. The car didn't explode. It didn't blow up. It didn't roll over. And I was stuck up under the dashboard, and I had a broken nose, and I had cuts all over me from the windshield. And the car buckled up, and I couldn't get my legs out from under the dashboard. And they finally got two wreckers, they said. They pulled the car apart and got me out. And I woke up in this hospital, and I saw this big, bright light, and I'd been there before in hospitals, other damage, and I didn't know if I was going to live or die. And I shut my eyes, and I saw Carol and those three children. And Carol was 4 months pregnant by this time. And for the first time in my life, I said an unconditional prayer. That's why I have such a strong faith and a strong belief in God. I simply said, God, please don't let me die, because who will take care of them? And as you see, I didn't die, but the drunk died that day, because this sober person could live. I haven't had a drink of alcohol of any kind since. No cough syrup, no nothing. I don't take nothing. Yeah, I don't take it. If I get a cough, Joan, or I'll go buy that Triaminic, that baby cough syrup. You got to drink a little more, but it does the job, you know, and it's okay, you know. My doctor knows I'm an alcoholic, and he don't prescribe no drug. I went in for surgery. They said, what are you allergic to? I said, alcohol. They said, what do you mean you're allergic? I said, I'm an alcoholic. Well, you're not allergic to alcohol. I said, yeah, I'm allergic to alcohol. They said, it says here codeine. I said, you got that right too. I said, codeine and alcohol. I said, I can't ingest it. Oh, he said, she said, if we rub it on your skin, it don't hurt you. I said, no. I said, as long as you close the bottle right away. You know, and I laughed about it. But I was telling the nurse and I was telling the anesthesiologist about Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they're getting ready to put me to sleep, you know. But I wanted to make sure that they knew, because I got surgery one time and this anesthesiologist told me, that don't matter, that don't matter. I told him I need more. And I woke up and I almost broke my neck because I was having face surgery, had my head in a clamp, and I woke up and I tried to get up. And I ended up in place they put you to recover. Recovery room, I was in there almost 11 hours because they put me back to sleep. So I wanted to make sure that this anesthesiologist knew that what was going on. But I woke up and I spit on the floor like a pig, and out come teeth and blood, and I thought, oh man, and I looked at me in my drinking uniform, and I had a drinking uniform. I had flannel shirts and blue jeans before they were in style, and that's what I wore. And if you get a brand new pair of 20-ounce duck blue jeans, you can fall down on a sidewalk in Hubbard 6 times before the knees wear out. And when they wear out, then you cut them off and make shorts out of them. And if it's winter or summer or fall, you just wear those shorts until you get a new pair of blue jeans. And then you put the new blue jeans on and you go like that. And I wore flannel shirts. And this is what I was reduced to. My brother came and got me, and he looked at me, and I saw the pain in his eyes, and he said, George, he said, I can't help you. He said, I can't do nothing for you. He said, why don't you go see Fred Miller? He used to drink, and he did something about it. Well, my brother Tom had seen Fred at a restaurant, and he got to talking to Fred, and Fred was asking him about me, and Fred told him that he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my brother Tom told me about him, and he dropped me off where I'd left my car. And I went over to the club, and I didn't see. I ended up at the club. I was looking for the clinic, but I didn't know where the clinic was. And I found the club, and there was a meeting there, and the meeting was just over, and some old-timers talked to me. And I didn't remember them talking to me, except one guy said, does your wife know where you're at? And I said, my wife's better off without me, because I wanted to be like the Marlboro Cowboy. I just wanted to ride off into the sunset. And I thought, if I just leave them alone, they'll be okay. Because they had a lot of insurance on me, and I thought, that's all they want anyway. I'm just a meal ticket to them. And if I ride off, they'll be okay. But anyway, he said, your wife wants to talk to you. And I thought, why didn't he leave her out of it? Carol simply said, just stay there. I didn't have any place to go. I wasn't welcome anymore. Any place. I wasn't welcome any place. Because I was an obnoxious, stinking drunk. People in the gutter didn't even want me associating with them. And I didn't want to be that way. Carol came and got me. She walked in the back door of that club. She looked like an old hag, and she was 32 years old. And I thought, my God, George, what have you done to her? And I can still carry a mental picture of her in my head. And if I had an artist that could paint her, I could describe exactly what she looked like. And she put her arms around me, this greasy, crummy old drunk. She said, come on, hon, let's go home. She put me in my father-in-law's brand new car, took me home, and in that house, on that couch, that day, which was my first son's first communion day, which I missed, I reached my bottom, because over and over and over and over and over and over, just like a broken record, went the same question, what in the hell are you going to do? And it went over and over in my head, and I came up with the same answer, I don't know. I don't know. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous many times during my life, but when it came my turn, I didn't know what to do. And that's why I feel it's so very important that we help that new person that walks through that door. And that's why it's so very important that we carry a message of hope to the alcoholic who still suffers, because I haven't met one person in the time that I've been sober and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that comes in here that knows how to stay sober. And anybody that knows how to drink don't make it here. It's us folks who think we know how to drink that make it here, because we don't know what to do. So that's why I believe it's very important, and I feel very strongly about helping that new person that comes through that door. Carol came home that night, and she went to bed and put the children to bed. Next day I went to the doctor, and I said, what about my broken ribs? He said, you got bruised ribs, you got a broken nose. He said, the end of it's broke. He said, I just want to make sure it doesn't drop. And I got a big nose. I couldn't afford it to drop. He said, it won't drop. It's healing already. I said, okay. He looked at me. He said, you know, you could have got killed in that wreck yesterday. Now, I went to this doctor every week for 18 weeks when I had a broken leg and a broken foot. I said, hey, doc, I could get killed walking down the street. And he did just what you find people did. He looked at me. He said, the man upstairs gave you another chance. What are you going to do about it? But he swore at me. And when he swore at me, the hair on the back of my neck went up, because I didn't like that. I thought, I got to tell him something rotten. I looked at him. I said, I'm going home and call my friend in AA. He said, that's the smartest thing I ever heard you say. And he walked out of the room. And there I was, sitting on his table with my foot in my mouth. But this time I had my shoe on. And I lit a cigarette. I smoked them little Camel cigarettes, and I used a Zippo lighter. Because Camels are packed loose. And when you're quick like I am, That lighter goes back and forth. If you're sucking real hard on that Camel cigarette through that paper with no filter, that flame will jump onto that light eventually. If you work it around long enough, you know, it goes this way. Got lit. Put it, act like cool, you know. Never wondering, knowing when you're going to get it lit. Shoot, I put up there one time, jerked and burned my eyebrow, burned hair in my nose. So, man, this is crazy. So then when I started doing standing like this, because I wouldn't stand like that, I'd stand like this, like that's nuts, all that work, you know, just being a drunk. I get in the car and I say, you're an alcoholic. No, you're no alcoholic. You drink too much sometime. No, you're an alcoholic. No, you're a drunk. Then I thought of the drunk Carol called me. I didn't want to be that kind of drunk. I said, be an alcoholic. No, you're a winehead. Well, I didn't want to be a winehead. I didn't like that expression. I didn't like people calling me winehead. I said, be an alcoholic. It sounds better than anything you ever been called. So that's why I said I'm alcoholic. It sounded classy to me. Isn't that crazy? I wanted to have some class. So if I say I'm an alcoholic, that sounds like I got class. Rather than winehead, I got home and I told Carol, I said, I got to call Fred. I stuck my finger in some holes. And that's why I believe what the big book says, God would do for me what I could not do for myself. I dialed some numbers and he was there on the line. He said, hello, George. I said, Fred, how are you? He said, I'm good. How are you? I said, I ain't too good. I said, I think I got to talk to you. He said, can you come down? He said, I don't have a car today. I said, yeah, I can come down. And Carol was sitting there crying, and my God, in his loving kindness, put his hand over her mouth because she didn't say a word. I said, I have to go see Fred, Carol. She said, bye. And I thought, oh, boy. And I went and I told Fred what happened yesterday, and he looked at me and he said, when did you have your last drink, George? I said, as far as I know, Fred, Sunday morning at 5:30. He said, didn't you have a drink today? I said, oh, Fred, I'm never going to drink again. He said, how many times did that work before? And you know them old timers, I love them. They ask you a question, and rather than you give them the wrong answer, they tell you the answer. He said, it never worked before, you wouldn't be here. He said, if it had worked before, you wouldn't be here. He said, you wouldn't have been laying in the snow. He said, you wouldn't have been laying in the gutter in the rain. He said, you wouldn't have got a broken leg. He said, you wouldn't have had your fingers wrapped up for 2 weeks when you got your fingers broke at work. And I thought, how does he know these things? He said, you wouldn't have woke up in the car with the windshield wipers going and the heat going and all the heat on and the windows rolled up and it's 90 degrees outside and you got yourself full of puke. He said, you wouldn't have put up with that. And I looked at him because I wondered how he knew all these things. But he was telling me about himself, and he was telling me about a few things that happened to me because he knew, because I worked with a lot of guys that knew Fred. And he looked at me and he said, we just don't drink today. And when he said we, it sounded like he was including me in something, and I had a good feeling because I was never included in nothing. He said, you want to go to a meeting tonight? I thought no, yes came out of my mouth. Just like that, I said yes. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself because here I was. I was a commissioner of the minor league in Hubbard. There were 28 teams. There were 28 coaches. There were 28 assistant coaches. I had to go around and make sure they had all this equipment, you know. Because I thought if I do all these things, people won't think so harshly of me when they see me falling down on the street in Hubbard, drunk. They'll say, oh, he just does a lot for the town, you know, a lot for the kids. He said, good, I'll pick you up at 28. I said, okay. He said, you want to go to the clinic? I said, no, I don't want to go to no clinic, Fred. He said, no, shake. And he swore at me. He said, that way you'll remember how you felt when you had your last drink. I didn't know what he was talking about. You know, I shook off drunks before. I'd last 2 or 3 days, shakes got so bad, take a couple drinks, be all right, you're not an alcoholic because you're not drinking every day. Fine. I know if you got the bad shakes and you can't get a drink, 6 Hershey candy bars, if you eat them right in a row, they stop the shakes for a half hour. I used to keep that candy machine wiped out at work. I'd eat all that chocolate candy, and them guys would be wondering, what the heck's wrong with me? Well, I'd be going on a wagon to prove to everybody that I wasn't an alcoholic, see? Fred took me to my first AA meeting. I went home. I told Carol, I said, I got to go to a meeting tonight, but Freddie's picking me up at 28. And I changed my clothes and I took a shower and I put my one shirt on. I had two shirts, one pair of slacks, one suit. Carol kept that clean for funerals and weddings because she said, I'm not going out and buy you a suit if you get buried. I said, okay. So I put on my two shirts because I sweated one so bad that I had to change and put the other one on. He came, got me his brand new car, took me to the meeting right up in front of the door. We got out, walked in the door. People shook hands with me. They said, it's nice to see you. Fred said, this is George O'Neill. He's going to give us a try. And I went to that meeting. He got me a half a cup of coffee. I shook it full. I sit down. I listen to a guy talk. And I'm sitting there, and this guy's talking about things that happened to him that happened to me. Then he starts talking about things that haven't happened to me yet. And a voice in my head said, you're at an AA meeting. And I said, oh, yeah. And Fred turned around. He said, what'd you say? Because, man, when I came into AA, once the meeting started, you sit there and pee your pants, but you don't get up or you don't say nothing. Because you might disturb somebody, you know. I said, I didn't say nothing. He said, okay. After the meeting was over, he said, let's go tell the guy thanks. I seen the basket pass, and I seen people throw them dollars in. Now, here I am. I'm stealing. I'm working two full-time jobs, and I don't have a dime to put in that basket. In fact, I was trying to scheme a way to get a handful out. But I thought, better not do that. So anyway, he said, let's go tell the guy thanks. I said, okay. He talked to the guy. I told the guy, thanks. He said, it's nice to see you here. And I thought, why is he happy to see me here? I don't have nothing. And I thought, uh-oh, he thought I put a dollar in the basket. That's why he's happy to see me, because he thinks that I think that's what he's getting paid, and he thought I put a buck in a basket, and he's happy to see me. Wrong. Fred said, let's get a donut. He said, us alcoholics need the sugar. Okay. He got me one of these glazed twisties. Now, here I am. I got this long, curly hair. I got this glazed twisty. I'm pouring, the sweat's pouring out of me. The booze is pouring out of me. This glaze is running down my elbow. I got a death grip on this twisty because I don't want to drop it. I got a Camel cigarette in this hand, and it's flat. The sweat's running off my hand, and it's making the paper brown. And I'm trying to suck on that cigarette, drink that coffee, eat that twisty, and I'm falling apart. And an old-timer comes over, and he sits down across from me, and he looks at me. He said, hey, George, I said, what? He said, if you keep coming back, that'll go away too. And my God, who loved me, let me see myself for what I was at that moment, and I was falling apart. People come over, and they talk to me, and I don't know what they said. But the only thing that impressed upon me was they said, keep coming back. Fred said, let's go home. I said, okay. I'm going out the door. People's hollering, come back now, come back. Come back again. Okay, you know, okay. Fred takes me home. I'm getting out of the car. He said, hey, George. I said, what? He said, if you stay sober today, he said, kneel down on the floor and say thanks. He said, tomorrow morning when you wake up, he said, if you want to stay sober, he said, you kneel down on the floor and you ask for help. I said, okay, Fred. He said, I'll see you tomorrow night at 28. I said, okay, Fred. And he left. And I walked in the house, and Carol's sitting in a rocking chair, and she's crying. I said, Carol, I found what I'm looking for. She said, whoopee. I said, you don't understand. She said, no, and I don't want to understand. I said, I'm going to bed. And I went to bed, and I thought, uh-oh. Fred said, kneel down. I kneeled down on the floor. I said, whoever keep Fred Miller sober, thanks for keeping me sober today. And I got in bed. And I slept like a baby. I woke up at 7 o'clock with no alarm clock and got up and I kneeled down on the floor and I simply said, whoever keep Fred Miller sober, help to keep me sober today. And I went to work and I put my time in. And it was about 3:30 and the guys that I drank with, hey, you going to stop for a drink tonight? Nope, I'm going home. You going to stop for a drink tonight? Nope, I'm going home. What's the matter, you candy butt? You can't drink? No, man, I'm an alcoholic. Well, you'd have thought I told them I had the bubonic plague. Them guys were trying to dig in that sand to get away from me. Because they didn't want what I had, see? They thought they were going to catch it. And from that day until the day I retired, nobody in that plant has asked me to have a drink. See? I went to Foreman's party after I was sober 3 years, and I walked in the door, and a guy said, George, you want a drink? And another guy said, yeah, he's drinking 7-Up, and that's what I'm getting him. It was out of my hands, see? It was okay. Fred took me to 6 meetings in a row and a Sunday morning breakfast, and he said, stay home tonight, George, and get a balance in your life. And I did, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. I had to earn my way back into that family. I was the biggest and the toughest one in the family. And I could have demanded that I'm taking a checkbook and I'm doing this and we're watching this TV program. But Fred said to me, stay home tonight. Spend some time with your family. Get a balance in your life. They didn't want me there. So I walked up the street and I smoked a cigarette. I said, I'm going to walk downtown and get a drink. No, you better not do that. Because just about the time you do that, Fred will call and say, where's George? And they'll say, we don't know. And he's going to call all you people in AA and say, kick that bum out. And a voice in my head said, you're going to die on the street. So I walked back in the house. And I put a smile on my face. And Carol said to me, would you like a bowl of popcorn, George? And I don't even like popcorn. And I said, yeah. And Georgie said, Dad, how about an RC? I said, okay. And everybody moved over and gave me a room to sit down, you know. And I started earning my way back into that home. I started earning their respect back. I started showing them that I was respectful. I started showing them that I loved them, not only telling them. I became dependable. And my sponsor was a great one for working the 12 steps. And he's telling me, work these steps. Take this program home and work it. And treat everybody at home like you treat them at AA meetings. He said, you did more damage at home than anybody. And I started to do this. And I worked those steps. And I tried to live them. And I tried to incorporate them in my life. And I was going to meetings. And the next day he said, I'm not picking you up no more. He said, I'll see you tomorrow night in Girard. And I thought I swore something or said something wrong. I said, okay, I'll see you there. And it took me an hour to find this meeting. This meeting was only about 15 minutes from my home, but I'm driving up and down this street because I couldn't remember because it was a week ago. So I said, I heard them guys say, if you say that serenity prayer, it helps you. And I'll tell you now, that serenity prayer is magic. Because I drove past this place 5 times. And I said the serenity prayer, and that church rose up out of the ground because there it was right there. It was right there. I said, man, that's the church. And I wheeled in. And I got there, and I left home at 7:05. And it was 8:05 when I walked into that meeting. And I knew I was late because the meeting was 8:30. And you had to get there by 7:45 or you was late. And I walked in the door, and I'm soaking wet with sweat. And I looked like a maniac. And I see Fred and I shake hands and I said, boy, am I glad to see you. He said, I'm glad to see you too. And Matt, the old timer from our group, he was there. I said, boy, Matt, I'm glad to see you. He said, I'm glad to see you too, George. And from that day until today, I'll go to meetings with somebody if they want, or I'll go by myself because meetings are important to me. Meetings are where I get my help. Meetings are where I meet people. Meetings are where I learn how to live this life. Like the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, says the basic text for living. It doesn't say the basic text for not drinking. It doesn't say the basic text for staying sober. It says a basic text for living. And I do those. I try to do those things. I come home from work one day. Carol said, I took Fred to the doctor today. I said, oh, man, what's the matter with him? Now, this was strange because I was working from 6 at night till 2 in the morning. And usually, since we had the children, Carol would be in bed. And it was fine. You know, I'd get something to eat and I'd go to bed. And it was okay. But she was up this night and she was making supper for me. She was making a big cooked meal. And I knew she was nervous. And I said, what's the matter? She said, he got terminal cancer. And here I said, God, why are you picking on my sponsor? Why don't you pick on someone else's sponsor? And the name of a fellow that I sponsor came into my head, and a voice said, I'll pick on his sponsor. That would be me. No, I said, And I learned right then that I have no right to put a question mark where God puts a period. That I don't have to like things, but I have to accept them. And see, my God loves me enough that he allows me to tell him I don't like it. And I said, you know, God, I don't like it. I said, because Fred is my friend. And I said, I love him and he loves me and I like him and he likes me. I said, but I know I got to accept whatever happens. But you see, I didn't know that that was getting me ready for something that was going to happen in my life some years later. And Fred died. in February of 1978, and the fellow that was leading the meeting on that Monday night was the same fellow that led my first AA meeting, and I hadn't heard him lead from that first time until then. And I had stopped to see Freddie was in a nursing home, and he looked at me and he smiled and I hugged him and he hugged me, and he was pretty frail. And I saw Carol walk in the door with another fellow that I sponsored, and she said, "Come on, George, we gotta go home." I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "Fred passed away." And I thought, "Oh boy." And I was there for his wife, and I was trying to be a comfort to her. And I had to get another sponsor, and I got another sponsor, because I knew that I had to get another sponsor, and I knew that I couldn't drink, and I knew that a drink wouldn't help him. So I just kept on going to AA meetings and doing what I'm supposed to do. And one day I came home from work, and Carol said, "I was at a doctor." Well, in the meantime, both my parents had passed away. My mother passed away on Christmas Eve. And I got to the hospital before she was cold, and my dad looked at me and he said, "You know, George, I'm awful proud of you." And I said, "I love you, Dad." And he said, "And I love you," he said, "but I'm proud of the way you've changed your life around." I said, "Dad, it wasn't me." I said, "It was my friends in AA." I said, "All I did was not drink." Because my sponsor, Fred, God love him, he'd say, "If you don't drink, everything will be all right." I say, "Well, how am I going to know?" He said, "Well, just don't drink and you'll find out." I said, "Yeah, Fred, but how am I going to know everything's all right if I don't drink?" He said, "Well, if you don't drink, George, you'll find out." I said, "Fred, you don't understand. I want to know how it's going to be all right." He said, "Just don't drink. You'll find out." And I thought, what's the matter with this guy? And I heard this first drink. "No, don't take that first drink." And I thought, I never drank one drink. "Just don't take that first drink." And one day that lady on that black velvet billboard was standing there. I was going to a meeting, and she had that bottle like this, and she had that big smile on her face. And I said, "By God, that's what they're talking about. If I don't take a drink, I can't get drunk." I get in that meeting, and Fred's there, and Matt's there, and I said, "Hey, you guys, you know what?" I said, "I found out something coming here this morning." They said, "What?" I said, "If I don't take a drink, I can't get drunk." They said, "What do you think we've been trying to tell you for 9 months? Jeez. It was long about that time, 9 months of sobriety, I found out you could say no. I said, "I'm going to try this no. I hear everybody saying you could say no." I said, "I'm going to try that no." The guy said to me, "You want a cup of coffee?" I said, "No." He said, "Oh, okay." Fred said, "That don't mean anything in AA that's a request." I said, "Oh." I thought, he's reading my thoughts. These old timers, they read your thoughts. They know the answer before the even question is asked. And I kept going to meetings, and I kept doing things what I'm supposed to do. And I didn't get into service until I was 19 years sober. And I come home this night. Carol said, "I want you to report off work and go to the doctor with me in the morning." And she'd never asked me that before. We went to the doctor, and he checked her, and he said, "Carol, I want you to go have x-rays." They gave us the x-rays, took them back to him. He looked at them. He said, "Here's the name of 3 prominent surgeons. I want you to go see one of them." We go to see one. He examines Carol. He looks at the x-rays. This was a Thursday. He said, "I want you to be in the hospital Sunday because I'm going to operate on you on Monday." I said, "Hey, wait a minute." I said, "That's pretty fast." I said, "You're making it." See, I was getting that big eye. "I don't have no say in this. How come I don't have a say?" He said, "Mr. O'Neill, it's very serious." Okay, well, he found out Carol had cancer, breast cancer. And she did fine for 3 years. And I come home from work one day, and she was sitting there crying, and I'd been going to meetings, and I'd been praying, and I met a Catholic priest in New Jersey, and he looked at me, and he didn't know me from Adam. He'd never met me before, and I haven't seen him since, and he looked at me, and he said, "Leave Carol go, so God can work with her." Where do you get that? And he was gone. He was gone. And I looked around and I never seen him no more. And we were at some kind of conference. And I never saw him after that. I was praying the wrong prayer. I was praying for Carol to be like she was, not for her to have some peace. Because they found out she had bone cancer. and it was eating her up. And it was the kind that would grow inside her bone and make her bone expand. And they told me, don't grab her, don't hug her, don't jerk her, don't help her up, don't do nothing to her. And I didn't for 2 years. And all I did was go to work, go to a couple AA meetings, and stay home and take care of her. And a tornado hit our house, and boy, it blew half of it away, you know. And no reason to drink, material thing, it'll be rebuilt. I got a lot of insurance on it. And we're living in a trailer, and she's doing the decorating. She's getting a hold of the decorators and everything, and she's picking out the furniture, doing all this stuff, because she's going to move back in that house. But she didn't make it. On October 22nd of 1985, Carol passed away. And it was kind of a relief, but I missed her, you know. And my kids said to me, what are you going to do, Dad? I said, I got to go to an AA meeting. They said, what? I said, I'm going to an AA meeting. Anybody want to come? I said, I got to go drink some coffee and hug an alcoholic and shake an alcoholic's hand. I said, and listen to their problems. I said, because I don't have none. I said, your mom's in a better place than I could provide for. And it went well. My AA friends were there, and they were supportive, and I got mixed up in a second marriage. My two boys were in the Navy at the time. They were submariners, and I had two daughters at home, and I got in a marriage that lasted 9 months, and it was my pick, as Joan said this morning. It was my pick, and it didn't last. 2 months we were in counseling, and I was the butt of all the jokes and everything. And I didn't like that. And I said, what I've been doing has been working for 17 years, and I'm going to keep doing it, and I'm not going to change. And I got to live my life the way God chose me. And if you don't like it, too bad. And my nephew asked my sister, he said, Mom, does alcoholics have blackouts when they're sober? And she said, I don't know, Jim, why? He said, Uncle George must have been in a blackout when he got married to that lady. And another lady told me, she said, that was the meanest, nastiest woman that I had ever met. And she had 8 years of sobriety, and I thought she was pretty neat. And she was exactly the opposite of Carol. And I thought that's what I needed, see, but my thinking gets me in trouble. And I don't think, and when I hear an alcoholic say I think, I start running. Because if I hear him say I feel, that's fine, because feelings aren't right or wrong. But thinking can get messed up, and my thinker can get messed up. And I went to an Al-Anon conference, as Joan said, and I met Joan again. We had met a long time ago because her and Carol were friends, and we renewed our acquaintance. And I wasn't going to do nothing. I figured I'm just going to let it go. And I let it go. But God didn't see it that way, because I could clean house and I could cook. I could sew buttons on. I could put hems up in clothes. I could wash and iron. Shoot, I could iron shirt. I could do anything. And I didn't need no woman in my life. But that's not the way God saw fit. And we got married. We had a great time. And she got four sons. And they didn't know me. And I didn't know them. And they didn't know where I came from or where I was going. And they're all big fellas. And I went to hug one of them. And he thought I wanted to wrestle. But we had a little tussle. And we're great friends today. We're great friends today. He loves me and I love him. And Joan had five grandchildren. And I only had one. And I wondered if my kids didn't know what to do, you know. But now, we got 15. We got three adopted grandchildren. A friend of mine, his parents passed away, and his children are little, and his wife's parents live in Israel, so they don't have any grandchildren here. So we were at the dinner at their house, and the little boy said to Joan, would you be my grandma? And she said, sure, I'd be your grandma. Yiddie's his name. He said, would you be Eli and Fazzie's grandma? And she said, sure. He said, what about grandpa? He said, I'm going to go ask him. And he asked me, and I said, yeah. So we have 15 grandchildren, and they're great, and they love us, and we love them. And my one grandson, he's 17 now. He's a wrestler. He was a Greco state champ in the state of Ohio, and he come in sixth in home freestyle for the high school, and he had two bad knees, and he had to have surgery. And he got a letter of intent from Penn State, and he had to send a form back to him. And on this form, it said, who was the two most influential people in your life? And he wrote down, my dad and my grandpa. And to think that would happen to a drunk from the gutter. And I'm a panel 45 past delegate, and I had the honor to chair the Saturday night meeting when, oh my goodness, I can't think of her name now. Dr. John, his wife, Ellie Norris, Dr. John Norris's wife, Ellie. They presented her with the 15 millionth edition of the Big Book. And she was a sweet little lady, boy, God, she was a honey. And she come up to me and she said to me, I want you to sign my book. She said, and I want to give you my name and address. She said, if you're ever up in Massachusetts, she said, I hope that you would come and visit me. And I started to cry. Because here was a guy who was a drunk and a thief and a bum from the gutter, and somebody was saying things like that. Just like when I see you people and you say, it's nice to see you. It gets me in my heart and it keeps me coming back, because I know if I take a drink of any kind, I throw this all away. And I know that that's not the answer to any difficulty that I might have, because my book says how it works and into action. It doesn't say how it thinks and into thought. And it says, rarely have we seen a person fail. And it says, I stood at the turning point. And what's a turning point? Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And this is my turning point. When I live these steps in my daily life, not perfectly, but I strive for spiritual perfection. And I want to thank you people for listening, and I want to thank you, Milton, for asking us. I'm not the man I ought to be, and I'm not the man I want to be, but by the grace of God and you fine people, I'm not the man I used to be. Thank you very much.